It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, philosophy in the streets, and the cafes, and the podcasts. The famously incomprehensible discipline of philosophy is all over popular culture. The Army's teaching philosophy. Professional sports teams are hiring philosophers. In this hour, why a bunch of dead white guys still matter.
The Stoics were a group of philosophers in Athens, and they were kind of open source philosophy. They taught just in the streets. And what I love about their philosophy is how incredibly practical and accessible it is.
You read philosophy because you're interested in the truth. Even when they get it wrong, they help eliminate false paths.
For Plato, the philosophical life, the life of reason, the examined life, that's the only life that matters.
Modern-day philosophers find inspiration in some unusual places. When Mark Rowlands was a young professor, he adopted a wolf. It became his constant companion, even a teacher of sorts, and the subject of his book, The Philosopher and the Wolf. Now, Rowlands has come out with a sequel, Running with the Pack, which offers philosophical lessons gleaned from a lifetime of running. Steve Paulson recently caught up with him.
Mark, you write about the heartbeat of the run. What kind of experience is that?
Basically, it's an experience of being sort of lost in the run, so that you're no longer thinking anymore. I mean, I talk about it as a heartbeat because I've run most of my life, I suppose, with dogs or canines of various sorts, and you know, there's a certain kind of place you get in the run where, you know, you're just surrounded by the panting of the dog's breath and the click of their claws on the tarmac and so on.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, you make the argument that running is intrinsically valuable. I mean, not because it makes you feel better or makes you thinner or healthier, although it can do all of those things, but
yes.
There's something about running just in itself that is good.
It's a conclusion I arrived at, painfully slowly, really. I mean, when I was 27, I did something, well, a bit stupid, really. I acquired an animal called Brennan. He sold to me as a wolf. I think it's quite likely he was a wolf-dog mix. But whatever he was, he sort of grew up. And one day my thoughts were disturbed by the sound of a thud, thud, thud coming from the room at the back of the house. The thumps were made by the sound of the armchair locked firmly in Brennan's jaws, being repeatedly slammed against the frame of the door. And I think it was precisely this moment that I decided that all things considered, it might be a good thing if Brennan were kept constantly exhausted, and thus began my life of running as an adult.
So basically, you were trying to wear him out.
Absolutely, and this sort of continued over the years. Our pack got bigger. There was Nina, sort of Malamute German Shepherd mix, who joined us, and then Tess, Brennan's daughter. I was running basically to keep this pack of three rapacious canines as mellow as I could keep them. Put in the sort of jargon of philosophers, I mean, philosophers would say, well, this means that running has what they call instrumental value. Its value is a means to an end. But I think over the years, over the 20 years or so, I discovered that less and less was I running for some specific purpose. And more I found myself running simply to run.
Well, I want to take you back to your personal history, especially with your wolf, Brennan. I mean, a profoundly important relationship to you. And you said you first got him when you were in your late 20s, right? A young philosophy professor.
Yeah.
Sounds kind of impractical, frankly, to get a wolf when you're a teacher.
Well, it quickly became clear, like within the space of a few hours, that Brennan could never be left on his own for more than about 2 minutes because he just started destroying things. And so, I mean, the upshot was that I had to take him with me wherever I went, you know. So I used to take him into lectures with me in... I'd give him a good run first, so most of the time he would sleep.
You know? Wait, but you'd be up at the podium in the lecture hall and the wolf would be at your feet?
Usually over in a corner of the room at a kind of safe distance from me, yeah.
What did your students think of having a wolf in the room?
Well, there were never any sort of complaints anyway. I mean, after a while, you know, I became known as the wolf guy.
And would Brennan just sit there the whole time or would he start to wander around?
Most of the time, sometimes things would go a little awry. I mean, you can imagine, for example, what force me to put this little appendage on my syllabus. Note, please do not pay any attention to the wolf. He will not hurt you. However, if you do have any food in your bags, please ensure that those bags are securely fastened shut.
Meaning there was an occasion where it was not securely fastened shut.
Precisely, and the student's lunch disappeared before their eyes. I mean, sometimes, you know, he would just wake up and start howling, you know.
In the middle of a lecture?
Yeah. I'm sure the students probably wish they could do the same, actually. But
And then you talk about how you were an avid rugby player. You were part of a local team. You travel a lot, and Brennan would always go with you.
Yes, I mean, pretty much everything I did, you know, we lived our lives in, I suppose, each other's pockets. I mean, any socializing I did, you know, bars and parties, and I did a lot of that when I lived in Alabama. You know, he would have to come too. If I went out on a date, you know, he would play the lupine gooseberry. So our lives were pretty much, you know, lived within each other's eyeshot, you know, for the whole of 11 years. When Brennan was around four, we moved from the U.S. to Ireland and then on to Wales, England, and finally to France.
That must have been hard to take a wolf into another country.
Well, the first part of the trip to Ireland was hard because this was in the days of quarantine, before they had pet passports and things like that. And so Brennan had to go into quarantine, essentially, you know, jail for dogs for 6 months.
Wow, that's a long time.
It is a long time, yeah, it is a long time. After that, there was no problem. I was able to move him from one country to the other with no difficulties at all.
Now, in your previous book, The Philosopher and the Wolf, you say at one point, much of what you learned about how to live, about life and its meaning, you learned from Brennan. And what it is to be human, you learned from a wolf.
Yeah.
It's an extraordinary thing to say.
Yes, because of the kind of relationship we had, where we were basically within touching distance of each other for this large period of life.
You must have thought about what it means to be a human, as opposed to what it might mean to be a wolf. And my sense is that in your ledger, the wolf actually might come out a little bit on top of the human. Yeah.
So this did start a kind of period of reflection on, you know, the idea of human superiority. The Philosopher and the Wolf was kind of basically an examination of probably the three main ways we distinguish ourselves and think of ourselves as better than other animals. One way is, you know, we're better than them because we're smarter, we're more intelligent than they are. Another suggestion that philosophers have had is that we're better than animals because we have morality and they don't. We're moral beings and they're not. And the third is that we're different and we're superior because we understand that we're going to die. And I wanted to examine the difference, you know, whether these stories really, whether they held water. And so, for example, I examined the idea of intelligence, and I argued, you know, drawing on the work of primatologists like Andrew White and Dick Byrne and so on, the so-called Machiavellian intelligence hypothesis, that intelligence within us has you know, fairly dark roots, if you like. It's evolved to a considerable extent to allow us to deceive and manipulate our fellow apes.
Because that's how we exist in a highly social community. I mean, we have to kind of read other people and to some degree, and manipulate them so we can get what we want.
Yeah, that's the idea.
Well, and that leads directly to then the other thing that you were talking about, morality. And I can't imagine a wolf doing evil, whereas humans clearly have the capacity to commit atrocities.
Yes, I think to an extent that's right. I mean, there's a certain kind of malice aforethought, if you like, that you find in apes that you don't find in other creatures. I mean, the sort of the violence that occurs between wolves of the same pack, at least, it's mostly sort of spontaneously, non-premeditated, just eruption of violence. It's over quickly, and most of the time, no great harm is done. I'm sort of struck reading a passage from Franz de Waal's book, Chimpanzee Politics, where he talks about a disagreement between two chimpanzees. One is heading over to beat the other, basically, because that's the way chimps like to sort out their grievances. But he stops on the way to pick up a rock so he can beat the other ape more viciously. And so it's that kind of premeditation, I think, that makes what humans do and other apes a different kind of wrong, a different kind of evil than the sort of thing that animals do.
Well, and then let's get to the third thing that you mentioned, which is that humans have knowledge of mortality, that they're going to die. And I'm guessing that wolves probably don't have that. They probably have no sense that they are going to die.
Yes. In order to understand death, you really have to understand the concept of nevermore, that death is final, irrevocable, and nevermore will you be around. And I'm not convinced that any other creature than a human understands the idea of nevermore.
And it's fascinating to think about how our lives would change if we had no awareness that we're going to die. I mean, I can't even imagine what that would be like.
No, I don't think any of us can, really. I mean, there was a kind of episode, I suppose, which bears on this. Brendan and I, we were living in France. Brendan had cancer, and he was going to die. And he sort of became apparently healthy again. You know, on one day he sort of did his usual party piece, which was basically an invitation for me to take him for a run. We hadn't run together for over a year because of his illness, and we went out for a run. You know, a last run together. And there's something about that. I mean, if I had cancer, you know, cancer and other mortal diseases, because we understand we're going to die, they're afflictions of time, you know. For animals, it's not the same. I mean, it's about how they feel in a particular moment. At this particular time, I feel fine, therefore I'm going for a run.
You have kind of a heartbreaking scene about Brennan's death.
Right.
You were in France at the time, and you took him out to a place where you had often walked to bury him.
Yes. Yeah.
And then you had a kind of vigil over a fire at night, and you seemed to almost have a vision of seeing him in a pile of stones you had constructed. Can you tell me about that?
Brendan was put down that day by the vet. Yeah, I buried him near where we were living. Basically, decided to stay there for the night. It was January in the south of France. It was pretty cold, so you know, I sort of built a fire. I'd built a sort of a funeral, a sort of cairn, a stone cairn to go over his body. As it turned out, the stone cairn was it looked very much like Brennan, the way he used to lie down, nose touching his tail, and so on. No doubt at the time, I might have thought, well, it's got to be the Jack Daniels I just consumed, but in fact, it looked the same the next day and the same after that, which is very, very strange. I mean, I have various sort of explanations of it, but it is a very strange, very eerie experience. Yeah, I referred to it as this ghost of stone, and it did look like him.
Mark Rowlands is a philosopher at the University of Miami. He's the author of The Philosopher and the Wolf and Running with the Pack. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Does philosophy still matter? According to some well-known scientists, not much. Stephen Hawking has pronounced philosophy dead and replaced by science. Neil deGrasse Tyson recently said he doesn't have time for the deep questions that distract philosophers. But Rebecca Goldstein, who is a philosopher, argues that her discipline is more relevant than ever. She's just written a book called Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away. So we asked her, what's so great about Plato?
I've been fascinated by Plato for a really long time, which is not to say that I think he got everything right. But what fascinates me about Plato is that he carved out the landscape of philosophy. Philosophy consists of so many subgenres, you know, philosophy of math and philosophy of art and philosophy of language and philosophy of history and philosophy of science and philosophy of knowledge itself. And Plato, in some sense, lifted the whole continent of philosophy up single-handedly. And that's kind of amazing that this one man did it. And I'm also interested in the fact that he was an ancient Greek. Philosophy was in the air. So I very much wanted to see Plato in the context of the ancient Greeks. They're amazing. They were the super overachievers of all times. The Greeks had already, non-philosophically, been approaching this question of what do I do to achieve a life of mattering, that basic existential question. Do I matter? Is there something I have to be or do in order to matter? And they answered that question not in terms of their gods. They were a very religious society. Their culture was drenched with religious rituals. But when it came to this most fundamental question, they didn't look to their gods. It was the last thing they wanted. Something always terrible happens if the gods pay too much attention. They looked to each other. They wanted to do something big and magnificent. The Greek word for it is kleos, a kind of glory. And then the fame that you win from that glory. Plato very much rejected it. But the thing that he did accept, and that we, who have gone much farther from him, might want to question, I certainly won't want to question, is that only the extraordinary life really matters. Ordinary life doesn't matter. I don't think that we believe that anymore, but I don't think that our full understanding of that really emerged until the Enlightenment. For Plato, what he did accept from his Greek milieu, and this is what makes him a Greek, is that, yes, you have to do something very, very big and extraordinary, but not all kind of extraordinary matters. For him, really, the philosophical life, the life of reason, the examined life, that's the only life that matters. If you look at the history of science, you see that it often begins with philosophers, right? That the first so-called physicists and cosmologists, which is back in the ancient Greek world, they were philosophers, and they were asking the questions that eventually physicists and cosmologists would be able to answer. What is, you know, this stuff that we see all around us? But just speculating about it, not using the empirical methodology, which doesn't really emerge in its full glory until the 16th, 17th century, really the 17th century with Galileo and then Sir Isaac Newton. Philosophers should not be in the business of describing physical reality. We have science for that. But one of the places, I think, in which we can really find progress made by philosophy is in the realm of morality. If you look at many of our revolutions in moral progress, they start with arguments. This is the real crux of how philosophy proceeds, you know, trying to maximize our coherence. And it's interesting that often an argument that's already been accepted will then be co-opted by another group. So when slavery, the argument against slavery, finally came to be accepted, people like Marianne Sell said, oh, and by the way, the same argument applies to women. And this was, you know, in the 17th century. So it takes a really long time. Nobody wants to change their mind about these things if it's in their self-interest not to. But fortunately, we do not like the feeling of being inconsistent. And if you really get it rubbed in your face that you are guilty of an inconsistency, you know, you may try to wiggle out of it for a long time, but eventually the change is made.
Rebecca Goldstein is a philosopher and novelist and the author of Plato at the Googleplex. You'll find an extended interview with her on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, how philosophy can save your life. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking this hour about the practical value of philosophy. Jules Evans says philosophy saved his life. Turns out that cognitive behavioral therapy, one of the most widely used psychotherapeutic treatments, was actually inspired by ancient Greek philosophy, something Jules says he discovered the hard way.
When I was a teenager, my friends and I did lots of drugs just for fun, including quite a lot of psychedelic drugs. And when I was about 17, I had a couple of bad trips on LSD, and they left me rather traumatized. So for about 6 years, I suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder and panic attacks. But my real terror was that I'd kind of permanently damaged the chemistry in my brain, and there was nothing I could do about it. And then finally, when I was, I guess, 22, I went to a therapist, a kind of expensive private therapist in London, who diagnosed me as suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, social anxiety, and depression. I think he was being paid per diagnosis.
That's so I got quite this, a potent this, mix.
Yeah, and he wasn't actually able to cure me, but I researched those conditions on the internet and found that they could be helped by this type of therapy called cognitive behavioral therapy, which is kind of now the most evidence-based form of therapy, and it's very popular.
So how did you go from CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, to discovering philosophy instead?
So I discovered that these emotional problems could be helped by cognitive behavioral therapy, and I found a support group, and that got me better. So then in 2007, I became fascinated by cognitive therapy, and I went to New York to interview the founder of CBT, Albert Ellis, and did what turned out sadly to be the last interview he ever gave before he died later that year. But I got to thank him for inventing this therapy and asked him where had it come from. And he told me he'd been inspired by his first great love, ancient Greek philosophy, and particularly this line from the Stoic philosopher Epictetus, "Men are disturbed not by events, but by their opinion about events." So in other words, it's not what happens to us that causes our emotions, good or bad. It's how we interpret what happens to us through our beliefs, through our attitudes, through our values. And that really got me interested in ancient philosophy. And I spent most of my 20s reading the ancient Greeks and Romans and discovering how incredibly accessible and practical they are.
Huh, that's fascinating. Well, so did the ancient philosophers actually think of philosophy as a source of healing?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Epicurus said, empty is the argument that does not cure suffering. Cicero, the Roman politician and philosopher, said, there is a medical art for the soul, and its name is philosophy. Philosophy teaches us, he said, to be the doctors to ourselves.
It's so interesting that today, you know, if you feel depressed or anxious, you might think of visiting a therapist. You would never think of going to a philosopher. I mean, philosophy as a discipline seems to have left behind the practicality of the ancients and become a much more abstract medium.
That's right. So about a century ago, philosophy, ethics, and psychology were kind of one discipline. And it was kind of a tragedy in a way that psychology and philosophy split apart in about 1900 and became separate academic disciplines, jealously guarding their own respective territories. Because psychology ended up trying to become an evidence-based science, which meant it left out any questions of ethics, because you can't really scientifically test ethics. So psychology became a bit like a chicken without a head, whilst philosophy was all about speculative ethics, but without any real grounding in experimental psychology. It became just like a brain in a vat. So I'd say the two disciplines really need each other.
So if I was feeling bad, depressed, say, and had the opportunity to visit not a therapist, but a philosopher, maybe one of the ancient philosophers magically come back to life, what might he or she do? What would the treatment look like in practice?
Well, I don't know if they did one-on-one therapy, but I mean, usually you'd go to a class, say you go to one of Epictetus's classes, and often he would single out one of his students for some kind of philosophical examination. And ask them what kind of values they were living by and how that was making them feel. Epictetus thought that a lot of the time when we're suffering, when we're really upset or anxious or angry or frustrated, it's because we're fixating on things beyond our control. A lot of life is beyond our control. For example, if you put all of your self-esteem on looking great, your body and your looks are to some extent beyond your control. We're all getting older, we all get sick, and one day we're all going to die. So if you build your philosophy of the good life, if you think what's really important is your appearance, that's a recipe for feeling unhappy.
You mentioned the Stoics. We should be clear, this is Stoics with a capital S, not Stoics with a lowercase s, which simply means having a stiff upper lip. Who exactly were the Stoics, and what is it about their philosophy that you find most relevant today?
The Stoics, with a capital S, they got their name because they were a group of philosophers in Athens. They first appeared about 100 years after Socrates' death in the 3rd century BC. They taught just in the streets. And what I love about their philosophy is how incredibly practical and accessible it is, and how well they understood the emotions and how to transform them, which might seem strange because, as you say, Stoic today means someone who basically denies or buries their emotions. So if you say the football coach was very Stoic after that defeat, you mean he doesn't really show how unhappy he was. But for the ancient Stoics, they weren't about just repressing emotions at all. They're actually about really understanding how your emotions arise and how you can transform them, not deny them, but transform them through kind of philosophical therapy. They were kind of the Buddhists of Western philosophy in that they had this idea of mindfulness, the importance of keeping track of your thoughts.
Jules, I know you now teach therapeutic or practical philosophy in all kinds mm-hmm. of settings. You've taught professional sports teams, prisoners, mm-hmm. people in assisted living homes. Yeah. What in general do you find is most appealing to people?
The idea, for example, of focusing on what you can control rather than obsessing over what you can't, to remain with an attitude of inner freedom, even in the face of real adversity. And that's why partly I think a lot of people in the army like the ancient philosophers. I interviewed someone in my book called Major Thomas Jarrett, who's a Green Beret. And he taught something called Stoic Warrior Resilience out in Baghdad. And he said to me, you know, your philosophy needs to work in all situations in life. Otherwise, it's just a cafe philosophy. It's just talk.
And what about the professional sports team?
Yeah, so I got invited to do a talk at Saracens Rugby Club, who are basically, well, they're one of the top two rugby teams in the country. And initially, I had no idea how it was going to go down. I started off by talking a bit about how I'd messed myself up on drugs, which felt, you know, being vulnerable in front of a room of 40 enormous rugby players was quite a strange experience. But to my surprise, they really liked it and asked me to come back. And I ended up running a course for the whole season and being a kind of philosopher in residence. And we had a kind of a regular philosophy club where you had about 12 or 15 of the players and the staff, including like some of the best players in the world. They would sit in a circle and bring in some of their own stories, some of their own reflections about coping with the pressures of professional sport on and off the pitch. Because sure, they get paid a lot and they get a lot of adulation, but actually professional sports people, there's a lot in their life that is beyond their control. If they get injured as they're getting older, the transition from being a kind of weekend hero to 2 years later being a plumber, say, or unemployed, there's a huge amount of attention paid to professional sports people's bodies. But when it comes to the inner life, when it comes to the emotions, often it's just kind of flat out denial until a sports person breaks down or kind of has a drinking problem or depression or you know, which happens to top sports people. Mm. So Saracens is a bit of a kind of exception in that it actually creates spaces for these very tough rugby players to sit around and actually be open about their inner experience. And because it's philosophy rather than therapy, perhaps they don't feel like they're at the head shrink. So they feel prepared to do that. I think philosophy sometimes works better for men, because men are more comfortable talking about ideas than talking about their feelings. So if you teach them about some ideas which are actually connected to their feelings, that's a good way to get them talking about their inner life and their experiences.
Jules Evans lives in London. His book is called Philosophy for Life and Other Dangerous Situations. One of the most famous episodes in the history of philosophy was the excommunication of the great Dutch thinker Baruch Spinoza. Well, today Spinoza is revered as one of the founding fathers of the Enlightenment, but back in 1656, he was branded a heretic by the Portuguese Jewish community in Amsterdam. His expulsion has haunted generations of Jews, but recently the Portuguese congregation in Amsterdam wondered if Spinoza should be exonerated. So they called on a few of the world's leading Spinoza scholars. Steve Paulson recently sat down with one of them, University of Wisconsin philosopher Steve Nadler.
Steve, you were one of several scholars who were recently asked to evaluate Spinoza's excommunication and whether it should be lifted, which I have to say is a little odd to consider. Why would anyone still care if Spinoza was a heretic?
I think partly it's a matter of a feeling of justice that there was a great wrong done by the Jewish community of Amsterdam and perhaps by Judaism at large, although you really can't speak of Judaism at large since there's no Jewish Vatican or Jewish Pope.
And over the years, various people have called for Spinoza to be exonerated. For instance, David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel.
That's right. And some rabbis over the years. The trouble is that they were completely unauthorized. The only people with any authority to lift the cherem against Spinoza would be the community that issued the cherem in the first place. So it was only the Portuguese Jewish community of Amsterdam that had the authority to even consider lifting the cherem.
So you and several other Spinoza scholars were asked to consider his case?
We were, but only as outside advisors. A member of the Portuguese congregation recently asked the congregation itself to consider lifting the cherem. And the leaders of the community and the rabbi felt that they really needed some more information about Spinoza's philosophy. And so they sent us each a number of questions about who Spinoza was, what were his main philosophical themes, what were the circumstances of the cherem, and in our opinion, what would be the benefits and drawbacks of having the cherem lifted?
Well, before we get to what you decided, we should talk a little bit about why Spinoza was such a radical thinker. His family were they were Sephardic Jews,
right,
who had fled Portugal years earlier because of the Inquisition persecuting Jews.
That's right. The community, in fact, of Amsterdam's Portuguese Jews were mostly former conversos, that is, Jews who had been forced to convert to Catholicism in Spain or Portugal in the late 15th and early 16th centuries. Many of these families, still ostensibly Catholics, moved to Amsterdam where they were allowed to practice Judaism openly. And so by the early 17th century, you have a fairly sizable community of Portuguese Jews, former conversos, who needed some help reconverting to Judaism.
So it was a loaded issue. I mean, what it meant to be Jewish in Amsterdam in the mid-17th century.
Absolutely.
I mean, there was the weight of history that was sort of hanging over these people.
That's absolutely right. And the rabbis had to enforce fairly rigorously what they regarded as a strict enough Jewish behavior to constitute this community.
So my understanding is that Spinoza grew up in a well-to-do family. He was a young merchant, and he started developing these radical ideas.
He did, and at a fairly young age, by his early 20s, there's good reason to think that he had really lost his Jewish faith, and he would eventually end up denying the providential God of most Abrahamic religions. So for Spinoza, God is just nature. There's no moral characteristics of God. God is not benevolent, just, or wise. In my view, Spinoza is essentially an atheist, somebody who thinks that all there is nature.
And what about the Hebrew Bible? I mean, was there divine inspiration there?
It depends what you mean by divine inspiration. There's a really important moral message in Hebrew scripture. It's a very simple one, and it's simply love your fellow human being and treat them with justice and charity. Everything else is a matter of storytelling and imaginative prophecies. Spinoza really was the first to argue in any extended way that Scripture is not literally the Word of God. Spinoza argues that what we have in Scripture are simply a compilation of human literature.
That must have been a radical thing to say in the 17th century.
Extremely radical. There were earlier thinkers who would deny that Moses did not write all of the Torah. But to say that the Bible itself is nothing but a work of human literature was a very radical thing, because the Torah and Scripture was supposed to be a source of truth.
So here was this young man, obviously this brilliant thinker, who was talking about this stuff publicly, right? And he was excommunicated when he was how old?
23.
Yeah. And then the language that the Jewish congregation there used to condemn him was strong. I mean, they said that he had committed abominable heresies and monstrous deeds. They said they would excommunicate, expel, curse, and damn Spinoza.
It is by far the longest, the most vitriolic cherem text of the period. In Spinoza's case, the document really holds out no hope for reconciliation. This is final. This is the end for him.
So he was booted out of his community.
Yeah, but I get the sense, my view from what I know of Spinoza's life and his thought, and also some documents from the period, suggest that he was on his way out anyway.
Hmm. So this didn't really bother him?
As far as we can tell, no. He has reportedly said that they're not doing anything to me that I would not have willingly undertaken by myself.
So here you and these, three other scholars had been given the task of evaluating Spinoza and talking about, okay, should his excommunication be lifted? What did you decide?
Three of us felt that there was no point in lifting the excommunication. First of all, because a harem is a personal ostracism from a particular community in his or her lifetime. But when the person is dead, there seems to be no point to lifting a harem. And Spinoza really, as far as most of us could tell, couldn't care less if the harem were lifted. So it wasn't clear what the point would be.
And so, for, I mean, your own view was, yeah, Spinoza was a heretic.
He, by 17th century standards. Now, let me say at the outset that I am not in favor of harems. It's still a practice done in Orthodox communities today. And I am firmly opposed to punishing people in any context for the expression of ideas. So I do not think it was a good thing for Spinoza to be put in a harem. Let me be absolutely clear about that. However, as a historian or somebody who studies the history of philosophy, it seems perfectly clear to me why he was put into harem.
To step away from this particular case and, you know, Spinoza's excommunication, I mean, one thing that I find fascinating is how popular Spinoza remains to this day. I mean, even more so than the other great 17th century rationalist, Descartes. Most people today say, yeah, Descartes was tremendously influential, but he was wrong on all kinds of things. And Spinoza seems to occupy a special place in the hearts and minds of a lot of people today. He seems contemporary in some
ways.
It's
true. You don't run into a lot of Cartesians or Leibnizians these days, but you do run into people who are, I suppose I'm one of them, are obsessed by Spinoza, in part because we think he got it right. And especially to my mind, I think to the minds of a lot of people today who admire Spinoza, his views on religion, personal faith, and the relationship between faith, reason, and politics.
It sounds like Spinoza also was the forerunner of the European Enlightenment, the dawn of secular thinking. I mean, Spinoza was talking about this before it became widely accepted among European intellectuals.
I think that's absolutely right. And Spinoza is often portrayed as being the first secular Jew or the first Reformed Jew. I think that's wrong. I think what Spinoza represents is the first truly secular individual, somebody for whom identification with a religious faith played no role in his sense of who he is.
Now, I know you have devoted much of your career to the study of Spinoza. You've written a lot about him, which does raise the question, why should we care about Spinoza or any of the 17th century philosophers? I mean, obviously they are of historical importance, but are there anything more than that?
Well, it's a huge question that you could ask about the history of philosophy itself. Why should we bother still reading Plato and Aristotle? You read philosophy because you're interested in the truth. And sometimes what philosophy, especially historical philosophers, give you, even when they get it wrong, they help eliminate false paths. But Plato got a lot right. He pointed us toward a conception of what knowledge is. Aristotle had a lot to say that still is of relevance in the field of ethics. I think in Spinoza's case, especially in today's society where there's a greater trend towards secularism, people want to know, what does it all mean? I don't think you can get a really informed answer or even a path to approaching that question without reading the great philosophers.
Well, that is a good place to leave it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Steve Nadler is a philosopher at the University of Wisconsin. He spoke with Steve Paulson. So what do you think? Is there a philosopher who matters to you? You can share your thoughts on our website at ttbook.org. Moving on from philosophy, it's summertime, and we'll talk with a peach farmer about writing, farming, and tasting the perfect peach. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
I'm Eric Jarosinski. I am the editor of Nine Quarterly, a fictitious journal of utopian negation found on Twitter, among other places. And I'd like to recommend Mythologies by Roland Barthes, the French cultural theorist. This book, it's a collection of short essays, I suppose you could say, sometimes described as philosophical vignettes. but largely about aspects of popular culture in France at that time, but things that aren't so foreign from us today. A lot about advertising, about photography, about museum exhibitions. And what he's interested in are ways in which really we make meaning out of our world, or ways in which meaning is constructed, and perhaps also very importantly, ways in which meaning is always constructed, that it presents itself to us often as being natural, as having already existed, or things having always been the way they are. Whereas what he's very interested in is something really not so far from the type of project someone like Nietzsche was interested in, about where do our values come from? How are they defined as good? And how are things that we consider evil defined as evil? His questions are largely about things like an ad for laundry detergent, soap powders. Why do we think our clothes should be purified? What should they be purified from exactly? Of course, no one wants dirty clothes, but an ad for washing powder is about something much larger. It's really about, in a way, a struggle between good and evil, between stories that we tell about ourselves in our culture, about who we think we are, who it is that we want to be. He talks about how ways in which the products we buy, the photographs we see in popular magazines, how those, in a way, are material products that we consume, but also about all the other immaterial messages surrounding those things that we're consuming at the same time. I think that people have become very interested in these kind of questions through the television show Mad Men. When you see Don Draper selling a slide projector, the carousel, no, this is not the slide-o-matic projection player of the future. This is a carousel. This is about memory. It's about movement. It's about nostalgia. That's what Roland Barthes is all about, ways in which those narratives that we have about our everyday lives make their way into any number of everyday decisions and hopes and fears that we might have, but that they come from somewhere both deep within, but also ways in which they're constantly manufactured, exploited, instrumentalized. And it's the kind of book I love to teach, because once you've read it, you'll never see the world quite the same way again.
Eric Jarosinski with his recommendation, Mythologies by Roland Barthes. You can find more bookmarks on our website at ttbook.org. And it's time for On Our Minds. It's summertime, and we've been thinking about peaches. Did you know there are more than 2,000 varieties of peaches? Alberta, Dixie Red, Snow Beauty, Southern Rose, and the peach many consider the best in the world, Suncrest. It's an heirloom variety from California's Central Valley. David Mas Masumoto made them famous with his award-winning memoir, Epitaph for a Peach. And his daughter, Nikiko, recently joined the family tradition of farming and writing with a book called The Perfect Peach. Nikiko, tell us a bit about the Masumoto family farm. It goes back several generations in your family.
My Jichon, my grandfather, in 1948, he bought the first 40 acres of our farm. And when he did that, his mother, my great-grandmother, she was actually very upset with him, because the whole family had just gone through this incredibly traumatic experience of being forcefully relocated and interned during World War II. And for me, as a Japanese-American, as a fourth generation on this land, I believe that was his way of claiming a place here in the United States and saying that even though the family and all Japanese Americans had just been publicly discriminated against, he was going to plant roots, literally, and make a place where he belonged.
The very first line on your family farm's website is, "We grow stories." What's the connection between farming and stories?
I think of farming as another form of performance art. You know, we are absolutely involved in growing an aesthetic experience. And when we have the opportunity to make that connection through those stories with eaters, that to me is like the applause at the end of a performance.
Is there a piece that you'd want to read or perform for us now?
Absolutely. So I'm going to read the head note to a recipe for peach day pickles. So this really gets at the nuance of the land and the history of our particular farm. Peach day pickles. In 2011, I took my first trip to Japan with my family. We visited relatives in the small village of Takamura in Kumamoto Prefecture, where one of my great-grandmothers was born and spent her childhood. Driving from the train station to the family farmhouse, I looked out the window to see a flat, sweeping basin of cultivated land under the protective gaze of distant mountains. I felt at home. The scene looked so similar to the view from our farmhouse porch in the Central Valley, bordered by the towering Sierra Nevada. Many years ago, as my oba-san, great-grandmother, worked on the same land that I work today, I wonder if she looked up at the Sierra and thought for a second that she, too, was home. But she lived and toiled in these fields when anti-Asian racism was legalized in the early 20th century by the California Alien Land Laws of 1913 and 1920, laws that prohibited Asian immigrants from owning land in the state. Asians were not wanted, not welcomed. And yet, here I am, a fourth-generation Japanese-American, and I call this place home. The roots of this recipe come from tsunomono, a lightly pickled Japanese cucumber salad I grew up eating. I wish I could share it with my oba-san. I wonder if her spirit is still in these fields, imagining that she is home.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
I mean, I'm just thinking that that really makes very, very visceral, doesn't it? The sense that it's the land that connects us and connects all those generations.
Absolutely. I feel haunted in a good way of haunting. I hope that other people feel that because my family, we're real people. You know, we're not rock star farmers. We sweat and we cry and we bleed and we worry. And I hope that other people feel that and appreciate that.
Now, in addition to working on the family's peach farm, you've also developed a series of kitchen story workshops. What are these? What do you do in them?
Yeah, I am a firm believer that everyone has a story and that everyone has a story about food and or kitchens. And what I love to do is start each workshop with just a little memory exercise where we create a list poem. So you just get a pen and paper out and you write the very first things that come to your head when you think of smell. When you think of an important kitchen in your life, what are the first three things you smell? And then just go through each of the senses individually. What do you hear in that kitchen? What do you see? What do you taste? What do you touch? And then what do you feel, as in your heart, your emotions, what do you feel? Just with a few sensory details, we all get transported, right, to these different unique kitchens. And I just find them fascinating and very powerful.
So what's a kitchen memory from you?
Much in the tradition of my family, I learned how to preserve from my mom, who learned it from her mom. I've grown up making jams every summer out of our peaches, and the preserves took on a really nuanced meaning for me after my jichon passed away. My grandfather died in 2010. He died in the spring, and every summer my grandmother would preserve peaches for he and she to eat every morning on top of oatmeal. They ate peach preserves every single day. And the year he died, my bachan was a little worried. Of course, she was mourning, but it was really beautiful the way the worry manifested. She was worried she wouldn't be able to finish the peaches that she had preserved for the both of them. So the rest of that year, we as a family ate the preserves that were meant for my jichon in a really bittersweet way of honoring him. And since that experience, the whole concept of preserves has taken on a much wider meaning to me. It's not only obviously about the physical preservation of food to save for the winter, but it's also about a preservation of memory, mm-hmm. Of people and of things that were once alive. Mm-hmm. And that has really made the preserving process a much more beautiful one for me.
You know, that makes me think about how in so many older cultures, there for centuries was a tradition of leaving food for the dead, still on the Day of the Dead in Mexico. And I think there's celebrations like this in Japan also.
There's a couple of, at least I understand them as rural traditions. In the summer, there's an Obono Dori festival.
That's what I'm thinking of.
Which is really colorful, and it's full of dancing. And the story is that you call the spirits back of the people who have passed on. And it's interesting to see how I understand the Dia de los Muertos tradition to be very strong in southern Mexico, in Oaxaca particularly, where a lot of indigenous cultures and a lot of rural cultures is still thriving and alive. And I think it's very interesting to draw those correlations between mm-hmm. the Dia de los Muertos and the tradition that I grew up with.
You know, I'm thinking really what we've been talking about is roots, your family yeah. roots, your food roots, but also your agricultural roots. Are there kinds of questions you would want to encourage all of us to ask about our own roots or think about?
I would love people to think about how their roots are related to the land and producing food. I think that a lot of people today, especially in my generation, I'm almost 28, and there's a lot of us who have lost those connections, but I think that they're still there. We just have to search them out. And so I would encourage people to think about their roots in food and food production and cooking as lifelines to who we are in the past and who we might become in the future. These stories are just so rich with detail. I would hate for these to be lost.
Nikiko Masumoto is a fourth-generation organic peach farmer, a performance artist, and co-author of The Perfect Peach, Recipes and Stories from Our Family Farm. And that's it for our show today. If you have comments or questions on anything you've heard, we'd love to hear from you. Just go to our website at ttbook.org or to our Facebook page. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson with help from Sarah Nix, Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, and Raymond Tungakar. Our theme music was composed by Steve Mullen at Walk West Music. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.